Welcome, everyone, to our debate tonight, sponsored by the American Constitution Society, the Federalist Society, and Outlaw. We're very lucky to have these speakers here who are, you know, on polar opposite ends of the issue and are two of the most prominent national figures on the issue out there. I'm just going to say a word about our moderator, and then I'll let her introduce them when they give their opening statements. But pretty much, we're going to go with the moderator for about an hour, and she's going to open it up to questions from you all. And we have microphones set up here, so you can just come down to the microphone and ask questions of the speakers. I do want to say a word about heckling, disturbances, that sort of thing. It is a very contentious topic. We all know this. It's very emotionally charged. Let's show both of our speakers a lot of respect tonight. You know, they're both out here, and they're both giving us what they really believe. And, you know, let their arguments stand on their own. Booing, hissing, any of that sort of thing is completely unnecessary. And we do have enforcers in the room for anyone who wants to get rowdy. So just be forewarned. We're very lucky to have Angie Quaro here as our moderator. Angie is host of KQED's Friday Forum in San Francisco. She's originally from South Bend, Indiana. She's been doing radio since she was a student, and she was very lucky to work in Honolulu, Hawaii for 6 years before she headed out here to the Bay Area, where she's been with KQED, I believe, since then. She won the 2003 Prindy Award for Best Interviewer, and she also won the 2003 Award for Best Talk Show Host in the Bay Area. So we're very lucky to have her here as moderator, and I'll let her introduce the speakers.
Thanks very much. Well, thank you all for coming in. I hope this is going to be an interesting discussion and debate, and everything Rhett said about civility goes double from here. I am the chief enforcer, so. I do want to move right to welcoming our panelists. The Reverend Lou Sheldon is head of the Traditional Values Coalition, and attorney and civil rights activist Evan Wolfson is to my left. Evan has dedicated his adult life to seeking equal marriage status for gays and lesbian couples. After directing the Marriage Project for the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, he went on to found the group Freedom to Marry and to write Why Marriage Matters, America, Equality, and Gay People's Right to Marry, and that came out last year. In 2000, he was named one of the country's 100 most influential lawyers by the National Law Journal, and last year, Time Magazine listed him amongst the 100 most influential people in the world. Evan Wolfson. Evan will give a brief opening statement, and then we will move to Reverend Sheldon.
Thank you. I want to thank the student groups for inviting us today to talk about this important civil rights question, and of course thank Angie for agreeing to moderate. And I want to thank Reverend Sheldon for agreeing to be here today and engage in a discussion. If we had more discussion in America and less efforts to shut discussion down through the abuse of constitutions, our country would be much stronger. So it's to his credit today that he comes before us to talk about what he thinks, hear what I think, and let you think it through on your own, rather than what we see in other forums and other places where people are trying to deprive not only Americans today, but the next generation of the opportunity to have this discussion and make decisions, trying to deprive them of that opportunity by cementing discrimination into the Constitution so that the next generation, the next group of people, in the course of their discussions, find it harder to make a decision and move our country and the law forward. The values that underlie our discussion today are very simple: love, commitment, fairness, freedom. And as you hear the arguments back and forth for why this exclusion of committed same-sex couples from the legal institution of marriage should end, ask yourself which position better reflects those core American values of love, commitment, fairness, and freedom. It took from 1776 until 1948 before even one court in the country had the courage to strike down race restrictions on who could marry whom. And when that court finally made its ruling, the California Supreme Court, by a vote of 4-3, the court said that the essence of the right to marry is the freedom to marry the person you choose. Human beings, said the California Supreme Court, are bereft of worth and dignity by a legal doctrine, a legal quote-unquote definition of marriage that would treat them as if they were interchangeable like trains. It's not, the court said, as if you'll just catch the next one if you can't marry this one. We marry the person who is precious to us, the person with whom we want to build a life, to whom we want to make a commitment and see that commitment receive public acknowledgement, public support, rules, responsibilities, and respect. And if we as a society believe that that freedom to marry, that that choice to marry, that that commitment, those responsibilities, those rights of marriage are good and beneficial and worthwhile for the community and for non-gay people, why would that not be so for gay people as well? When the California Supreme Court made that ruling in 1948, the first court to find the courage to do so, the polls showed 90% of the public opposed interracial marriage. It took another 19 years before this question of ending the exclusion of interracial couples from marriage reached the U.S. Supreme Court again, the U.S. Supreme Court having gotten it wrong previously. And finally, after that 19 years of discussion and battling, when that question came to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1967 in the best name case ever, Loving versus Virginia, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed with the California Supreme Court about what the essence of the right to marry is all about and struck down race restrictions. And when the court made its ruling in 1967, 70% of the American people opposed interracial marriage. Now ask yourselves, imagine, what would our country look like today if the opponents of equality then had succeeded in enshrining that 90%, that 70%, those prejudices of the majority, those passions of the moment, not just into law, but into the Constitution. But we don't have to imagine too hard, because we have such an opponent of equality here today who is in fact pushing to do that very thing, cement these prejudices and passions of the moment into the state and federal constitutions, including the constitution of this state. And as we talk this through tonight, ask yourselves, what will the country look like if America takes the step of fencing out for all time a group of Americans, a group of families, a group of couples from the legal equality that is every American's birthright?
Thank you. Reverend Lewis Sheldon founded the Traditional Values Coalition in 1980. The organization dedicates itself to grassroots lobbying with churches and individuals in defense of Judeo-Christian principles in America. TVC now claims 43,000 participating churches, all active in legislative issues. Reverend Sheldon received his Master of Divinity from Princeton Theological Seminary in 1960, and he is still a practicing Presbyterian minister. Reverend Sheldon, your opening statement.
Thank you. It's certainly an honor to be here today at Stanford, and also to be here with my colleague here who sits on the opposite side of the fence on this issue from me. Let me start out by saying that I think it's very important that we clear the air on certain very fundamental issues. The first issue being that genetically, never has the American Psychological Association or the American Psychiatric Association, or any school of medicine, or the National Academy of Sciences ever said, here is the gay gene. In other words, homosexuality is not, according to science in any way, shape, or form, a genetic trait. Having understood that, we need to understand also what courts have said is a true minority status. True minority status represents three things. First, a group of individuals who are politically powerless. Certainly, the homosexual movement today is not politically powerless. Second, it needs to have been deprived of cultural, educational, and financial access. And that certainly is not true. And then third, immutable characteristics related to the genetic factor, in other words, eye formation, hair formation, or color of skin. Once we realize that the whole homosexual agenda has started from one premise, moved to another one, and today is standing before the courts of America asking that they be considered to be considered a true minority status. Society has never before been confronted with such a concerted legal and political effort to forcefully redefine and undermine society's most vital and basic institution, marriage and family. And once you realize this, you come to the conclusion that this redefinition is not something that the American people are going to accept. It is not an issue of discrimination. It is not that at all. It is an issue of discernment. What does the doctor cry in the delivery room when the baby exits the birth canal? He cries, boy, girl, very clearly. And I think this is important because that in itself tells us that that whole thrust of male and female is a creative order that we have very little control over except possibly trying to determine what sex we want our baby to be. But there's just those two choices is what has been given to us. The basic unit of our society is the family. And the family is sexually, spiritually, and culturally brought together. The cornerstone of the family is marriage. And the essence of the marriage, as it has often been said in law, and certainly in church law, is the consummation of the sexual union of a man and a woman. Unfortunately, not all married people, couples, men and women, have children, but nearly 80% of those that do enter into marriage during the childbearing years do have children. The essence of marriage is this union of a man and a woman as husband and wife. And this unique association provides for society those factors that we can see from previous studies done by J.D. Unwin, who was a professor at Oxford University for many years and wrote a book, Sex and Culture. And J.D. Unwin went around the world for 3 years and studied all of the cultures that were all the way from New Guinea to South Africa to South America to outer Siberia and parts of Mongolia that were rural and unknown. And each of these 86 cultures that he studied, he found this conclusion that he wrote in his book, Sex and Culture, that those cultures that succumbed to fornication, adultery, homosexuality, and other promiscuous things collapsed. Now, this gentleman was not, quote unquote, an evangelical conservative Christian. This man was a scholar. He was an anthropologist. And his record in his book, Sex and Culture, is to be read and to be studied and to be understood. So this unique association provides the social, economic, and health benefits for children. And children stand at risk when we redefine marriage, because every child needs a father and every child needs a mother. The roles may change. Talked to a very good friend of mine just yesterday in Washington. She's the breadwinner and he's a stay-home daddy. He told me he changes diapers and so on and so on. So the role can change, but he's daddy and there's mommy. My mother worked every day when I was a little boy, but I was taught how to meet her at the bus stop. And my father was a traveling salesman.
Reverend Sheldon, I'm sorry, your opening time is up. Yes, it is.
We'll stop.
All right, very good. One of the things we're going to talk about tonight as we go on, and we try to uproot some of the language that comes up in this debate all the time. I know each of you has points you'd like to refute from the opening statement. If that doesn't come up in the course of the conversation naturally, please draw me back to it. First of all, though, we often hear the definition of marriage as sacred, and that's used different ways depending on the person who's hearing it. As we have someone who is rooted in the Christian ethic and someone who is rooted in the legal world, let me put to both of you, what is the role of the sacred, the appropriate place of the sacred in legislation and law in the United States? Let's start with Reverend Sheldon.
Well, I think our first president defined that very clearly in his farewell address of 1796 when he said, "Of all the dispositions and habits that lead to political prosperity," now we all want political prosperity, good roads, good law and order, good health care, good education, good environment. "Of all the dispositions and habits," Washington said, "that lead to political prosperity, there's two indispensable supports, morality and religion." And he said, "Woe unto those that would remove religion and morality from the process and the system."
Evan?
Well, I'm glad that Lou Sheldon acknowledges there's a difference between religion and morality, because too often we have people in his position.
No, I didn't say that.
Well, George Washington did. Perhaps that's good enough for some of us.
I don't think he meant that. He said, the two are together.
You're quoting, not me. I think you're actually taking Washington out of context, because Washington was also, as indeed most presidents have been very careful to do, is to underscore that our country is founded on the idea that government should not be used as a weapon to enforce religious beliefs on people, that one of the great things about the United States is that while religion is important to many of us, indeed most of us, part of the importance of religion and the sign of how important it is that we understand that one of the ways to preserve freedom of religion is not to allow the government to base its actions on the religious views of some, even a majority, in imposing them on others, even a minority. And of course, in this case, we don't have a conflict between religion and the government, because what we're talking about here tonight properly, for those who are not trying to blur the line, is the legal right to marry, R-I-G-H-T, not religious rights, R-I-T-E-S, of marriage. The religious rights of marriage are up to each church, synagogue, religion, mosque, temple, to define for itself. And government has no business telling those religious entities whom they must marry. But neither should religious entities be dictating to the government who can get a legal marriage license and the legal and economic and practical benefits and responsibilities that come to people through the law. Government doesn't issue baptism licenses, doesn't issue communion licenses. It issues marriage licenses, because marriage is a legal institution. And when it comes to that legal institution, the best way to preserve religious freedom as well as personal freedom is to respect, as George Washington did, the separation between church and state.
Lou Sheldon, that's in line with what a number of people have suggested as this debate has ground on for years, is that if you separate the issues of that which is sacred and allow it to a religious institution and that which is in the interest of the government, fiscal elements, et cetera, tax collection, and you leave that to the government, that that would obviate a lot of the problems with same-sex marriage. How would you feel about that?
Well, I think the issue here is that a person doesn't check their values and belief system when they walk into a job, if it's with the state or with the private industry. And so a politician, when he is elected to either school board, water board, state legislature, or federal government at any level, nationally, doesn't check his values and belief system before he goes into his public office. And I think that it's simply a big lie and a smokescreen to talk about separation of church and state. The separation of church and state is something that really started, if you understand the history of it, and the Orthodox Jewish professor from the University of Chicago, Philip Hamburger, wrote an excellent book, and I would encourage all of you law students to get that book, simply called The Separation of Church and State. Philip Hamburger, full professor of law, University of Chicago Law School, and he says it got started because the Protestants were upset at the influx of Catholics into America and wanted to talk about a separation of church and state, because a Catholic had allegiance to the Pope and et cetera, et cetera. And that started in the 1830s. You don't really find, other than what Jefferson said in his letter to the Danbury Convention of Baptist Ministers in 1801, anything other arising in history of that nature. And really, today, this has come back to bite a lot of Protestant evangelicals who at that time were prejudiced against Catholics.
Well, before I take this over to Evan Wolfson, let me clarify with you. Do you believe there is any legitimate element of the separation of church and state?
Well, there's a separation of doctrine. If a person is a believer in a value and belief system, are they expected to become a dum-dum when they get elected to office and ignore those values and beliefs they have, that murder comes from the Word of God?
Evan Wilson?
Well, again, the distinction that
the
distinction that George Washington drew between religion and morality is instructive here. I actually began my comments by saying there are important values that underlie this debate, and no one is saying they should be checked. Indeed, I invited this audience and others to think about those values, values like love, commitment, fairness, and freedom. That's very different.
What about truth?
That's truth. Truth would be good, too. So is respect. But what would be good... What would be good is if we understand that those values are indeed distinguishable, and this is part of the entire lesson of the American polity, are distinguishable from using government as a weapon to impose one religious view on others through the weapon of the government. When politicians come into office with their values, they take an oath to preserve the Constitution, to make sure that the Constitution's guarantees of liberty and equality for all, minority as well as majority, religious as well as irreligious, are respected. They take an oath to do that. And most Americans, from George Washington on, have understood that part of that oath is to respect the distinction between imposition of religious views and upholding values. And to just give one concrete example to bring it back to our topic tonight, a Jewish couple cannot march down to a cathedral, bang on the door, and demand that the priest marry them there. Even with the civil rights law in their hand, they cannot do that. But the bishop cannot then turn around in that cathedral, pick up the phone, call the clerk's office, and say to the clerk, do not issue a legal marriage license to that Jewish couple because they do not conform to my religious beliefs. That's the difference between imposition of a religious view and the values.
Let me rephrase a portion of that question and bring it back to you, Lou Sheldon. If you were to be assigned the task of explaining your definition of marriage and your desire to have that in the form of law to a Wiccan, what would you tell the Wiccan?
Well, let me first speak to what he said. I thoroughly agree concerning the legality of institutions in terms of the church, not being able to the bishop, what you said. I thoroughly agree with that. And I think there's a stereotype out there concerning religious conservatives among liberals that we're trying to shove something down your throats. I think it's absolutely wrong. And I don't think you've begun to understand the values and belief systems that we have. I would fully agree that the bishop has no right to do that, and I don't know a bishop that would or a cardinal that would do that.
How about
and
a reverend?
I don't know of a Protestant evangelical national leader that would do that.
How about Reverend Sheldon?
No, I would not do that.
You're
and
doing
that's the
it.
Perception.
But you're
you see,
doing
you're trying
it.
To create.
Okay, let's let him finish.
See, that's the perception you're trying to create. And I think that's the fallacy of the stereotype and the injustice that is perpetrated by that attitude.
Well, then let's go ahead back to my question then, which addresses that directly, which is if you're talking to a Wiccan who has the full rights of an American citizen and who does not believe in your particular God or your particular set of religious rights, how do you explain to that Wiccan the justness of defining marriage according to a Christian ethic?
Well, to begin with, not all Americans are Christians, and I'm well aware of that. And therefore, it isn't a matter of my trying to impose any of what I see as my viewpoints on them. If they come and seek it from me, that's a totally different case.
And if she comes to you and asks you for your explanation why she should accept a version of what a God other than hers
well, then
has
you start with very basics, you know, with faith, with Jesus Christ, with the book of Genesis, and you walk them through what is this teachings of Christianity. And if it was a Jewish setting, I'm sure the rabbi would do the same thing in the Old Testament. or if it was a Islamic setting. So that's basically what you would do any time, because we're all out pitching something.
Evan Wilson?
Well, I would say that Lou Sheldon has the absolute right to make that pitch to people in the context of his trying to persuade them to lead the kind of life he thinks they should lead, in terms of his trying to indoctrinate them religiously, guide them religiously. That is absolutely his right. And if government were to tell him he can't do that, I would be right up there defending him. But that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is his effort to take that into the government, use the government as the weapon to impose that, to justify excluding a group of people from a legal institution that they seek to participate in with the same rules and the same responsibilities. One of the things that perhaps we can leave tonight agreeing on is that Lou Sheldon spent a lot of his time saying we shouldn't redefine the institution of marriage. The good news for him is I agree. I am not trying to redefine the institution of marriage. I am not thinking we are changing the definition of marriage at all. What we are trying to do is remove a restriction from the institution of marriage with the same rules, same responsibilities for those who are willing to enter into it and make the same commitment. There's nothing there about changing the definition of marriage. After gay people are allowed to participate in marriage, as Massachusetts has shown, nobody else's marriage has been changed. The gays did not use up all the marriage licenses. People still have the same legal responsibilities of care for one another that they had before when they got married. They have the same duties to their kids. Their kids still have the same safety net. The difference is that a few more families are now able to participate in this institution. So let's not hear any more specious talk about redefining marriage, because no one on this table tonight is advocating redefinition. What we're doing is advocating an end to discrimination, an end to exclusion.
I'm going to start this question with you, Evan. The U.S. government is based on modified majority rule. It's tempered with recognition of the inalienable rights of the individual. The latest Gallup poll, which is just out this week, indicates that majority opinion is moving away from support of equal marriage benefits for all. So what do you make of that, and what do you, in your position as advocate, owe to that majority in moving forward?
Yeah, well, actually, I don't put too much stock in that poll, and I think we're going to see polls bump up and down. And as I began by saying, when the court had the courage to strike down interracial marriage the first time in this country, 90% were opposed, 70% were still opposed at the time of Loving. It wasn't until 1992 that the American people showed a majority in support of interracial marriage. So fortunately in our country, we do have, as you said, two great contributions that we have made to political thought in the world, we as Americans. One is, as you said, the idea that kings don't rule, popes don't rule, the majority rules in most instances. And that was a great thing that America stood for and contributed. But there was a second equally great thing, and that was that not everything gets put up to a vote. There are basic rights, basic assurances that protect the individual, that protect minorities, that protect us as human beings, even when we are unpopular. Things that protect unpopular religious views, guarantees that protect unpopular Americans, including racial minorities, gay people, and even majorities who lack power, such as women. And so because we have both of those things to protect as Americans, it's very important that we not think that everything gets put up to a vote, because if we had that attitude, our country would not at all be the kind of country we look to and cherish today, and for that matter, nor would marriage. In our lifetime, in the lifetime of many of the people, at least up at this panel, if not in the audience, we've fought four major battles on the battlefield that marriage has always been just within the last several decades in this country. We ended race restrictions on who could marry whom. We ended the government's ability to dictate whether people had to remain in a failed or abusive marriage. We ended the intrusion of the government into the use of contraception and other important personal matters. And we ended the legal subordination of women in marriage. And in each and every one of those battles, there was a point at which the polls would have gone the other way, and the public, the majority, was on the wrong side as we look at it today. But fortunately, we pushed through and got it to the right place.
Lou Sheldon, your response to that, and I'd ask you to also include a response to what Evan was bringing up about the legitimacy of a threat to what marriage is. If a gay person is allowed to marry a partner, how is that a threat to other couples?
Well, let me first say that there's no question in our minds, throughout those of us that believe marriage shall only be between a man and a woman, and that marriage should be given a preferred status in the law, that clearly the homosexual activists are seeking to redefine marriage. You have to be blind, or you just have to be uninformed or live under a rock not to understand that. It's very clear, because when you look at the studies that are out from abroad, basically from the Scandinavian countries, including Holland, their studies after a decade of homosexual marriage and other kinds of other sexual arrangements, it is very clear that fatherless children is seriously on the rise. But that's the nature of a male. It's a predatory nature that the male has. So he would be bisexual, impregnate, go off, and that not take care of the children that they father. And you have a lot of that right here in America, of course. Also, you have the huge harassment of women who are experiencing the bisexuality of men and not fathering and staying and being close to the bride of your youth. So the whole issue of redefining marriage means that the basic unit of society is crumbling in Norway, in Scandinavian, I mean Norway and Sweden and Denmark and, of course, Holland. And these statistics are out. And now what was the thing you asked me?
Evan touched on the fact that there's an idea that by opening marriage to all people equally, that straight marriages would somehow be threatened, somehow the institution would be threatened.
Well, it isn't it is the institution, because what is the institution? The institution isn't just the male ego. The institution isn't just the feminacy of women and motherhood, but the institution includes men, women, and children. And it is the children that suffer, for there is no substitute for the role of a father. There is no substitute for the role of a mother. And that chemistry is totally played out. Listen, in San Francisco, I remember the day, May the 13th, when Dan Quayle gave his famous talk at the Commonwealth Club and mentioned Murphy Brown, the big, I mean, some of you are old enough to remember the Murphy Brown flag, very clearly. And then in April of that next year, which would have been 93, the Atlantic Monthly had a headline article right on the front page. Dan Quayle was right. Every child, the sociological study was in, every child needs a father and a mother. Now, just because the families are having problems in America doesn't mean anything. And I want to say one other thing in mentioning about the redefinition. We have many black churches in our coalition, many of them, and more than any other group, they have had persecution up to the top of their nostrils. They have experienced it. They sat in the back of the bus. They drank from separate water fountains. And you would think they would be the first to want to promote the gay and lesbian thrust of same-sex marriage, but they're not, because they understand that as fragile as family is and what is happening in their communities, this would only further deteriorate it. It would further cause it to crumble.
All right, let's take that over to Evan Wolfson.
Yeah, there's a lot there to respond to. First of all, just to be clear, civil rights leaders from Martin Luther King Jr. to Coretta Scott King to Congressman John Lewis, the last living speaker from the March on Washington in 1963, to Julian Bond, the chair of the NAACP, to Latino and African American civil rights organizations and others, have come out against the discriminatory attacks on the constitutions that Lou Sheldon and his groups are sponsoring, and have come out in support of ending the exclusion from marriage. So the true civil rights voices in this country, the voices that are speaking from a position of civil rights rather than a position of religious intolerance, have made it very clear that this is, of course, another civil rights struggle and part of the larger civil rights struggle in America, which is to end the exclusion of anyone from government institutions and government opportunities to participate fully in society. It's a little hard to respond to this notion that a decade of marriage in Europe has led to gloom and doom, when in fact there hasn't been a decade of marriage for gay people in Europe. So the facts that Reverend Sheldon is trying to recite from the right-wing talking points really just don't add up, because in fact Holland became the first country in the world to allow couples to marry in 2001. And since then, of course, the European countries, and by the way, this pattern is actually reflected here in the United States, the European countries that have moved furthest in the direction of ending the exclusion of gay couples from the structure of legal responsibility and rights, whether it's marriage or partnership, as it is in some of those countries, are the countries that have the lowest infant mortality rates, the lowest divorce rates, the greatest degree of health and stability amongst the population, and even indeed the lowest abortion rates. In the United States, we see the same pattern. The states that have the highest rates of divorce, the highest rates of adultery, the highest rates of infant mortality are the states where the Sheldon bandwagon of attack against gay people has been at its highest. And by contrast, the state that shows the best indicators of people doing well, including the lowest divorce rate literally in the country, is Massachusetts. There are no locusts descending on Massachusetts. There's no flood yet in Canada. But instead, what we see is families able to participate in a system of responsibility and support that indeed benefits them while taking nothing away from anyone else. And to hone in on one point, because this is another one of the right-wing talking points that got trotted out tonight, this notion that there is even one study saying that children need a father and mother or do best with a father and mother is a complete fabrication. There is not a single study that says that. But what the studies do say, and they are abundant, and they come from voices around across the spectrum, what the studies do say is that in general, not in every case, but in general, children do better when they have two parents. Don't specify men, women, men and women. Two parents, because in general, when a family is able to come together with two parents able to form a union, pool their resources, provide for the kids, give each other a break so that one can take a turn while the other gets a breather, in general, those parents are better able to offer more to their kids. And given that that is likely to be so, and is clearly as so for gay parents as it is for non-gay parents, why is Lou Sheldon and his apparatus punishing the children being raised by gay parents by depriving them of the protections and responsibilities and safety net and support that would come to those kids if their parents were able to marry?
I don't know what source you're talking about, but I am reading, and I would fully deny what Evan has just said. I mean, this is just typical liberal gobbledygook that these studies don't exist. And we'll just have to get them and bring them with us and pass them out. And if you want to leave your name, we'll pass it to you. And we'll post them on our website. Because it does exist. I mean, the whole creative order, the as it says in the Constitution, the God of nature, the Declaration of Independence, the God of nature, male and female. Boys relate to fathers. That's a key factor. Girls relate to mother. And studies have been out that the reason homosexuality can be a factor, that is gender identity conflict. I mean, there's only one kind of sex, that's heterosexual. You've got heterosexuals who have a gender identity conflict, and they cannot relate to the opposite sex because there's been some kind of a social disorder in their life. And you're to feel sorry for them, to be very sorry for them. And so consequently, when you have gender identity conflict, which leads to that social disorder, certainly in this day in society, when we have spent as much time as we have spent in the last 25 years on human rights, I understand you believe you want to have a marriage with the person. But we know, and statistics prove it, National Center for Disease Control proves this statement, that the multiple sexual partners far outreach all of the heterosexual extramarital experiences that people may have in marriage. And many married people are monogamous, and many people are virgins when they do get married. That is not to be snipped at all. The last thing I want to say before I pass it back to you is that there are many leaders. The chairman of the March on Washington in August 28th of 19, I believe it was 62 or 63, that Martin Luther King gave his great speech. The chairman of that is the leader of the federal marriage amendment in Washington. I mean, this is a leading person. He's a former mayor of Washington, D.C., Walter Faulkner. Believe me, I mean, you have to take this serious, because the African Americans represent about 13% of our population, but they're about close to in the high 70 percentile opposed to same-sex marriage.
I think we're best off to declare a standoff where statistics and studies are.
Well, I just want to give a name, since perhaps people can then go and look it up for themselves. And to mention just one, the American Academy of Pediatrics, which is the nation's kids' doctors, came out with a statement in 2002. It's helpfully mentioned in my book, Why Marriage Matters. And you can see there, and in fact, read it for yourself and make your own conclusion. But what they said is that the children being raised by gay parents are growing up just as happy, just as healthy, just as well adjusted as the children being raised by non-gay parents, that their kids would benefit like any other kids from having the two parents who are seeking to raise them if they're lucky enough to have two parents.
Okay, we're going to leave that.
Those
there.
That wrote it, I believe, were gay.
We'll leave that where it is.
It was well written.
So you proved my point.
We're going to move on to talk about the legislation that has, you know, past, present, and future.
Put the wolf to control the chicken hen.
Reverend Sheldon, we're talking now about the constitutional issues, and I think people on both sides were disappointed in the many things that ground their way through the state courts and moving into federal courts over 2004, that the state Supreme Court in California sidestepped the constitutional issue of whether a marriage is indeed between a man and a woman as defined by Proposition 22, California state law. As a strategic analysis, why did that happen, Evan? And do you think it is to our benefit that that has to creep through yet more review, or was that a place where California could have taken a stand?
Well, certainly it was a very disappointing day for the 4,000-plus couples who took on this legal commitment in marriage to match the personal commitment they'd already made in their lives. It was disappointing to them to have their marriage taken away because it wasn't technically done correctly, as the court held in a very narrow ruling. And that, I think anybody would feel it a very bitter day if they were told by the government that your marriage is now undone. But of course, it didn't take away the love, it didn't take away their commitment, and it didn't take away their determination to have a legal commitment to match that loving commitment. And in fact, they went back to court, as you know, and the case was decided initially by the trial court about 6 weeks or so ago in a resounding and strong decision written by a Republican appointee who said that there is no good reason for excluding these committed couples from marriage. Now, that decision will make its way back up to the California court, and I hope that the California Supreme Court will have the same clarity and commitment to doing its job that it showed in 1948 when it became the first court to strike down race discrimination against the same kind of thumping the table from politicians and even religious voices saying that if we allow interracial marriage, society would crumble, it would be destroyed, it would take something away from others, and of course, that just turned out to not be true. Our country is stronger because the courts and ultimately the rest of us had the courage to face up to the need to change the way we were treating people in our midst. And so I think it is a good thing that as the courts are having a chance to look at this in the clear, cool light of a courtroom and listen to the kinds of arguments being made on that side and realizing what they add up to and looking at the families and seeing what they're about, the courts are increasingly finding there's no good reason for that discrimination. And the good thing is, so as we have that discussion, so are more and more American of the American people. But what's happening is forces, heavily funded forces of intolerance, are seeking to deny people the chance to really think and talk it through by trying to shove barriers into the constitutions, a very radical thing in our country, and one that I hope the people of California and other places will reject.
Do you agree, Reverend Sheldon, that it is extreme and unusual to talk about adjusting a constitution, be it a state or federal constitution? And how do you feel that this issue rises to the level of changing something in a constitution?
Well, to respond first to what was said by Evan, 61.4% of Californians voted that marriage shall be between one man and one woman. That was very clear on March the 5th of the year 2000. The court decision, really dealt with the radical, totally illegal, flagrantly morally wrong position of Mayor Gavin Newsom, and he wrote later, at least it was reported in the San Francisco paper, that he conceived this idea while he heard President Bush in the 2003 State of the Union address talk about one man, one woman constitutional marriage amendment. So from that standpoint, I think you've got to realize that there is a force of something that is morally wrong. If you're going to take the oath, then you better obey the rules. And Gavin didn't do it, and that's very clear, and that's what the court was saying. And I think that's what the court was limiting itself in its jurisdiction, because the issue was the law as it stands, not necessarily what Prop 22 did. Now, Prop 22 will stand, and I think it's going to put a pretty bad dent in Assembly Bill 19 of Mark Leno's to change the marriage code just to two persons. Two persons could be married, according to Mark Leno's language, but the problem there is that a judge has said already, this is a separate judge, that the definition in Prop 22 was clearly that the people had to make the decision. The legislature couldn't change Prop 22 without first going to the people and saying, "Is this is what you want?" So if Mark Leno had gone and gotten the language okayed by the Attorney General and filed his petition and then got all his signatures and put it to a ballot and the people changed it, then 22 would go up in smoke. But I think we are all waiting, and I don't know if it'll be a year or longer before the California Supreme Court hears Kramer's opinion.
Okay, let me take you back to the question of how does this issue arise to the level of such urgency and such importance that it's worth modifying constitutions?
Because normal people who are in a good relationship in their marriage, who have children, and who are experiencing the union of that marriage in a number of ways, just shake their heads and scratch their back head and say, "How is this possible? This doesn't make sense." And to compare it to a racial discrimination angers the African-American community to no end. I mean, I've had these African-American pastors just get irate over the fact that they're trying to compare the marriage issue in terms, I'm talking about the segregation, not being able, white and black not being able to marry. Now, my son married a Hernandez. So we have an interracial family, believe me, because her descendants are from the part of Mexico that weren't Castilians.
Well, to be fair, though.
So I'm saying why does it rise to that level? It rises to that level because you're not dealing with a social policy that take it or leave it in terms of getting oil from the north slopes of Alaska to lower the price of OPEC. It isn't a kind of issue like that. This is an issue that every human being is a sexual being. And those of us who are married and heterosexual, or even single and heterosexual, And those who are not married and have girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever the relationship is, realize that there is not a prejudice. It's like something that just doesn't set right. It just doesn't set right. Now, this isn't prejudice. This is discernment.
Okay, we're going to have...
Discernment.
Could I jump in there?
You know,
yes,
if I can't see anymore out of these glasses, I have discernment to go to the eye doctor.
Let's get a response from Evan, and then we're going to move on to one or two more assembly and legal questions.
Well, first of all, I'm glad to hear that Reverend Sheldon welcomed into his family an interracial couple, because that is the right thing to do. It's not something that most Americans were willing to do quite recently, and many religious leaders and others were out there trying to lead the country in the wrong direction on this for decade after decade after decade, including several decades after the California Supreme Court had to step in and strike down the discrimination because the legislators and the public wouldn't, and for that matter, religious leaders wouldn't. And it was because of that lesson of history that the California chapter of the NAACP just about 10 days ago came out in support of ending the exclusion from marriage as a civil rights question and has pledged to support the marriage bill making its way through the legislature as well as the case in the courts. But I also think we should take a look at the way in which your question still was not answered, because even within California, the history of the last 5 years is quite instructive. It's true that people were stampeded into a hasty and ill-thought-out vote of reinforcing discrimination in 2000. But as a course of that, in the course of that conversation, support for ending the exclusion from marriage actually went up. And the very next year, the California legislature, not the courts, not the people, but the legislature, reflecting the popular will ostensibly, voted out a selection of benefits and responsibilities for same-sex couples and their families. They then democratically, in the course of discussion, in their duties as politicians and legislators, passed a much stronger partnership law that took effect several months ago, AB 205, that provides same-sex couples in the states with many of the legal responsibilities and protections of marriage. Reverend Sheldon's proposed constitutional amendment would not only bar the door to marriage for gay people for all time and prevent Californians from thinking this through anew, generation after generation, year after year, however it may go, keep them from making that decision with regard to marriage itself, but would also undo the democratically enacted partnership and other family measures that the legislature and various cities in this state, as well as private businesses, have put in place to acknowledge the needs of these families. And Reverend Sheldon's position is not only a position against marriage for same-sex couples, but indeed is against any measure of protection, large or small, no matter what the name, no matter what the degree. He is opposed to bereavement leave. He is opposed to health. Are you in
fit? I have a chance to respond.
Well, maybe we can make some news tonight, because it would be great to hear Reverend Sheldon call out in support of, for example, AB 205, the law that's now been enforced here in California for months, under which families are receiving some, not all, but some protections and responsibilities, and to pledge that his constitutional amendment will not in any way, with language vague or explicit, try to roll back any of those legal protections that Californians have fought for and won as a step toward full equality.
Reverend Sheldon?
Look, I don't know where you get all this information from, but I don't think it can hold water. Hastily, you said we did Prop 22. It's the word you used. That's a fantasy of your imagination. There was nothing hasty about that. We spent 2 years. We spent over $150,000 in focus groups and cross tabs and polling. Come on now. Forced the people into a vote? I mean, this is the democratic process. So you would condemn me for the very thing that's democratic and we did when we did Prop 22. I mean, see, you're talking about being dictatorial and you talked about being unthoughtful. That was a very unthoughtful and untruthful statement, that this was hasty, Prop 22, in the year 2000. We started in the year 1998. working on this with polling and whatever.
I didn't say that your apparatus of discrimination
you
was hasty.
You said it was hasty.
No, what I said was that you pushed the people into a hasty vote.
No, we did not push the people into a hasty vote.
Let's move into a response to Evan's other point, which is that he feels you are not willing to support the bereavement coverage and other things that have been extended
to. What I said was this, and I have said this, and I've said it all along. Power of attorney is a process of our law system. And any human being of age and capable and competent can get a power of attorney. So why should marriage, that's always been between a man and a woman, have to give up and have snatched from them the rights and privileges that belong to marriage? You, by power of attorney, you can have hospital. And by the way, the people that brought the lawsuit in Massachusetts purposefully forgot their power of attorney when they went to the hospital to visit their partner. Oh, we don't have it. Well, then you can't visit her. Well, why didn't you bring it? Well, the truth came out later. They purposely didn't bring it because they wanted to test the law. But you have to have that. But if you have a power of attorney, you can have all these things. You can leave all your property to people. So yes, you can have visitation rights. Power of attorney can do this.
Should my partner be entitled to have the Social Security that I pay into when I die?
No, because that's for married couples.
Aha. Uh-huh. Thank you.
I think that's actually
should
a very
my
good point.
Should the children we may be raising be entitled to have the Social Security protections and money that would come from the higher earning spouse?
You mean the children you adopted or the children you used to?
If there are children, there are children.
Yeah.
But let's say we adopt them, yes.
We're actually moving.
Should they be able to have that?
We're moving into the time that's allotted for the audience to go ahead and line up for your own questions and comments. We have two microphones, one on either side. We'll go back and forth. I would ask you to keep your questions concise, and if you can, don't give in to the urge to orate. Just make it a question. And I want to thank both of you for conducting a good and healthy debate, and I appreciate that. We'll start with this microphone here.
Sure. Thank you both for being here. Can you hear me?
Why don't you step down? There you go.
Okay. Now? Mm-hmm. Thank you both for being here. Mr. Wolfson, thank you so much. You're an inspiration. I am interested in, for those of us who align ourselves with your view, I think it's important to evaluate the serious and credible and well-thought-out arguments on the other side. And one of the ones that I find to be a sticking point sometimes is the argument that when you, the arguments about polygamy and how as a society we can allow polygamy and not once we allow for same-sex marriage and whether we should. And I guess my feeling is, well, perhaps there's no reason to outlaw polygamy. But I don't know where I actually fall on that. I'm sure you're faced with this question often, and I'm interested as to your position on that.
Yeah, I think the central answer to that question is that most of the time when our opponents of equality here bring that up, it's because they don't actually have an answer to the question that's really on the table. The question that's really on the table is why should committed couples like Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, who when they got married in San Francisco last year had been together 2 days short of 51 years, why shouldn't those couples who are willing to make a commitment have the same rights and responsibilities as other couples? When they try to go to polygamy or man-on-dog sex, as Santorum likes to talk about it, or marrying your cousin or your dog or whatever, it's because they don't have an answer to that question. It's an attempt to change the subject. What gay couples like Del and Phyllis, are saying is not, let's have no rules. Let's redefine everything. That's not what they're saying. What they're saying is, let us have what you have. Just as Reverend Lou Sheldon had the right to marry the person he loves, I presume, and is entitled, I'm serious, I presume he does, and he is entitled to respect and support, and that's to be commended, especially for her, as I'm sure you'll agree.
Well, that's longer than gay relationships last.
Gay relationships don't have the structure,
percentage-wise,
don't have the structure and support and encouragement that comes to families through the institution of marriage, which works for some, although obviously not for all. But just as Reverend Sheldon had the right to marry the person he loved and make a commitment in his case, to her, so should I have the right to make the commitment to the person I love. We can have all kinds of other social debates about other things, and there's nothing wrong with debating other things. But they should not be a distraction from the real question here, which is, if government doesn't have a good enough reason for denying these people the same right as other people, the right to marry one person who is precious to them, then government should not be able to continue doing it.
Let's get a quick response from Reverend Sheldon.
Yes, I think, where did she go? Oh, she's back there. Your question was concerning the issues in Utah. There's been quite a bit of publicity, and I thought that's what you were basing it on one man and several women. There, as you know, in Hilldale and Colorado City, which are cities right on the Arizona and Colorado line, there's been a huge amount of a break off from the Mormon Church, where there's a multi, and even the chief of police showed up at the hearing that the Attorney General of Utah held in those two joint cities in this open forum meeting, and admitted, you know, that he had three wives and children by all of them. No, I certainly do not support that. I know that stems itself from a religious belief of the Mormon Church in way in the past, but when they were getting ready to come into the Union of the United States, and the Congress of the United States forced them to abandon that doctrine, and it's been condemned by the Mormon Church, but there are still, you know, men will be men. And that's the problem.
I believe her question more had to do with tying the argument for same-sex marriage to the slippery slope of, if you allow same-sex marriage, you have to allow polygamy. If you allow it, you have to allow bestiality. There's no distinction between
According them. To what I see the judges today, these activist judges, yeah, they would do that. The activist judges probably would do that.
Vera.
I want to thank you guys both for coming. My name's Elliot Fladen. I'm graduating here. And I guess this question is for Reverend Sheldon. I actually have to say it takes a bit of courage to come into the lion's den and take your position. I know because I disagree with this law school in the Federalist Society myself all the time. And I wish I could help you out on this thing by asking you a softball question. The problem is I don't agree with you. And this is coming from somebody who generally is on the same side of the political fence in voting as you. Now, as far as I can tell, your argument is that for being against gay marriage is that at least the one that I find most credible, potentially, even though I disagree with it, is that it would somehow decrease the propensity of men and women to marry, which would undermine the family and would cause disastrous social effects. I've heard this argument bandied about quite a bit, but I've never really seen anything solid behind it. Is this an argument that you've investigated, or is this an argument that you're just inventing out of thin air?
Well, despite what my colleague here said, concerning the Scandinavian countries, I would encourage you all to go online and see what the statistics are in the report. You can go to the Heritage Foundation, and you can see that they have just simply quoted from these reports of what's happened after a decade. And gay marriage certainly began a number of years ago. It wasn't just in 2002 there. It goes back to the early 1990s.
Follow-up question? Are those correlational effects or are those causational effects?
Thank you.
What do you mean? I haven't spent three years in this institution.
There's a difference between correlation and causation. Correlation is two things tend to happen at the same time. But just because marriage is going down in Europe doesn't mean that gay marriage is the cause of that. There could be other factors that just happen to be enacted at the same time. So I'm asking you, with these heritage studies, are they correlational or causational, or do you simply not know?
No, they're a direct result. I'll use a simple Reader's Digest.
Do you have personal knowledge of this? Do you know this for a fact, that they're causational studies?
Do I have personal knowledge? No, I'm not gay, so I wouldn't be able to tell you that.
No, in terms of having read the studies and understand them.
Yes, I've read the studies.
Okay, so you can say they're causational.
Yeah.
Well, the answer to your question is, first of all, you don't have to be gay to write a good study. Number one. Number two, the so-called studies all boil down to one article written by one of the right-wing Kurtz, exactly. And they've been refuted up and down. A simple Google search will enable you to make your own conclusions on that. But I want to go to your actual question, because you asked actually a very good question, which is, part of the reason polygamy comes up is because it's a good, juicy way to divert the conversation from a question like yours. And the question is, how exactly does the alleged harm of allowing more couples to participate in the institution that that side supposedly thinks is good, how exactly does the harm work? Is it that gay people are going to use up the marriage licenses? Is it that non-gay people are going to stop wanting to go to that marriage club because gay people are in it? I mean, what is it? And of course, there is no good answer to that question because as Canada, as Massachusetts, as the European countries that have moved overwhelmingly in that direction, as indeed many other countries continue to move in that direction, have shown, if marriage is a good thing, if encouraging people to care for one another and give their kids a safety net is a good thing for non-gay people, why wouldn't it be good for gay people?
Okay, we're going to get to another audience question.
Yeah, hi. My question is for Reverend Sheldon.
Yes.
You started out your argument laying out the foundation that that because no studies have been published by, say, the American Psychiatric Institute or the American Medical Association that say that there is specifically some sort of gay gene or immutability to it, then that's kind of the foundation of how you can go about arguing this. So, or that's the foundation of why gays would not get equal.
That it's not a minority status like black, Hispanic, or Asian. That's what I said.
Right. In other words, that it's not an immutable trait.
That's correct.
So my question would be then, if some such study were to be published, hypothetically speaking, by some credible source, such as the American Psychiatric Institute or the American Medical Association, similar to the way that the American Association of Pediatrics, excuse me.
Don't take away. No. Not that that would be bad.
Right. So if they were to come down with such a study, would that entirely change your mind on the kind of the path of intolerance that you've chosen to take?
Well, that's a very hypothetical question. You know, I'm a practical person, and I'd have to see it first and then study it and believe it. I know what's happened in my life that's made me believe certain things that I believe, and there have been facts. And so this is not a matter of leaping in faith and wanting to believe it.
Well, I'm saying take a leap of faith with me here for just a second.
That hasn't happened.
Just...
It's too hypothetical. I mean, right now the facts say no, and I'd have to wait to see what the facts do before you consider any kind of a change. You know, why haul your umbrella around if the sky's blue?
I can.
It's not going to rain on you.
In fairness, there are studies underway. There are indications on either side of the question. And I think the hypothetical is worth examining. If in fact you're talking primarily that gay rights do not rise to the status of civil rights, I think it's worth examining whether in fact that hypothetical
is this the linchpin of your argument.
Yes.
Let me just say this. For a long time, probably a year and a half, it was a long time for me, I debated Simon LeVay, who did the exhuming of those 41 dead bodies, 21 had died of AIDS and 20 didn't. And he came out and said, hey, the hypothalamus is different on those who were gay. It was smaller. It shrunk. And so he said, you see, it's genetic. Well, then pretty soon, all these other people tried to ask questions, and he couldn't answer the questions. Well, then, how old were these people? And did you examine them when they were 10 years or 15 or 20? Or did you wait till they were dead? You wait till they were dead. The point is that that question came and came and came. And finally, when the Simon LeVay thing surfaced, it was never repeated. So his theory went up in smoke. And
let's
get
a response to that.
Yeah. Well, I would say that while it is true that there is not conclusive scientific fingerprinting as to where exactly, if at all, the genetic origins of sexual orientation, heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual, whatever it may be, for that matter, of course, we don't have that genetic fingerprinting for bigotry either, that even though there's not conclusive evidence, to the extent there is scientific evidence, the scientific evidence that we do have all suggests, and indeed the experience of most people suggests, that sexual orientation is something that is deeply rooted, largely beyond a person's choice, and something very central to a person's attraction and outlook in life as the person moves forward. But having said that, and putting that on the table as something that is very central to most people's experience, that I don't think Lou Sheldon could point to the day he decided not to be gay. But I want to make a different point because I actually thought of it when he was starting, and I'm glad you gave us a chance to come back to it, and that is that there are actually two paradigms for civil rights protection under the American constitutional scheme and in American constitutional history. One is this idea that people should not be punished, should not be disadvantaged, should not be harmed on the basis of deeply rooted or immutable or even hard to change traits, even when those traits do have some degree of social construction, such as race. That's one important paradigm and strand of American law. But there's another, even older one, and that is the idea that people should not be punished or disadvantaged for something that is a matter of their choice, but still very, very important to them, as in the case, for example, of religion. Religion is not genetic. Religion is not deeply rooted. Religion can be changed. And yet we believe people should be protected in their choice with regard to religion because that's part of what it means to be free.
Okay, another audience question.
Thank you.
Hello. I have like three things I'd like you just to clarify about your position, Reverend, and one sort of like actual question. So my first thing had to do with the genetics thing. I'm wondering, like, if most of your constituents actually believe in genetics and evolution and things like that.
Well, evolution and genetics are two different things.
Okay. So,
you know, right. Go ahead.
I mean, I realize that they're two different words. Yeah. But so what I'm wondering is, like, did God make those genes that, like, if there were a gay gene, would God have made it? Or if there were a gay gene, would that just be something that scientists said about something that didn't really have to do with where people came from anyway?
Well, if you're asking me what I believe, I really believe that very clearly, and all you have to do is look around this room, we are created in our anatomies, male and female, and that creation is done for purposes. Why is the male creative order much different than the female? And the responses, as I said earlier, basically men can be predators and women are home builders. They're nest builders. They like that.
I think I sense some disagreement in the audience.
I would have never known it.
Okay, but so just to be clear, I mean, about your position about genetics, well, okay, I won't press you on that.
Genetics?
Genetics
is the color of my hair. It's the color of my skin. It's the size of my ears. In the case of females, it's the size of other portions of their body. I'm short. Some people are tall.
Can you move into your second clarification?
Sure. Second point to clarify is you were saying that the basic unit of society is the family. And I'm wondering, did you mean like the basic unit of all societies or the basic unit of American society? And if so, what's your authority on that?
J.D. Unwin, the great anthropologist that wrote the book Sex and Culture.
Did that person write the Constitution?
No.
Okay,
why?
So I'm wondering like how you would define the basic unit of society, like whether you think the basic unit of society is something that's legally defined, like something that we define on purpose.
The basic unit of society,
or if it's just a fact.
When they wrote the Constitution was implicit, excuse me, was
when they wrote the Constitution, the basic unit of society was the plantation.
No, I disagree with that.
Well, actually that
it was the family.
But the question does
remember that was just for the rich. And the rich were few then. Very few.
And they were the ones who were allowed to vote in many states. I thought you had finished.
No, I hadn't.
Okay.
So the majority, it was the family unit. All you have to do is read many of the historical accounts of the people of that time, especially the book on John Adams.
You know, I'm going to, if you can make your response quick, I want to move on to your question as we have more waiting.
Well, I just want to, when you do look at that history, you see that, in fact, the way marriage was defined, the way family was defined, and for that matter, the way citizenship was defined throughout many stages, even of American history, putting aside other society, was very, very different from the way we would define it today. Everyone knows only men could vote. Only men could own property. What people don't always realize is that the so-called legal definition of marriage in our country that, for example, said that women who married men lost their right to hold own property, to get a credit card, to take out a mortgage. That was part of the legal definition of marriage until as recently in many parts of our country as the 70s and 80s. That was considered the intrinsic, the natural, the necessary, the factual, the God-ordained definition of marriage. Well, that was wrong, and we changed it.
And I led the fight in several states. Believe me.
Okay, with that, we're going to have your question. We're going to have one more question here.
Give that freedom to women.
And then we're going to move to our closing statement. So a question here.
I'm not going to fight
Reverend
the kingdom of God.
Okay, we're going to move on here.
Okay, so the third thing to...
Or your question, one or the other.
One or the other?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll just ask the question then. The clarification, because it's shorter. Do you think that people who aren't heterosexuals should pay taxes in the United States?
What? What'd you say?
I said, do you think people who don't practice heterosexual sex and heterosexual marriage should pay taxes?
Well, if you work and work for an employer that's honest, you're going to pay taxes. I don't care what you are. If you're a pedophile, you'll do it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. One more question here.
Hi, I think I'm the minority here. I'm not a law student. I'm a concerned person who is a member of PFLAG. And I just want to ask Reverend Shelton, when your organization goes to conferences, why are the words hate and kill on your signs for people who are, quote, I guess not normal? I guess I am not normal, is that correct? But I just wanted to know why you hate so many people.
I would say that, ma'am, is a serious stereotype that somehow has developed. I know of no organization that I associate with, and I can tell you for sure there's none of that that uses those words in my organization, and I would be first to rise up against it. And that's part of the same mentality that Evan had over here in terms of, you know, the stereotype that we're some demon.
Your signs say hate and kill.
Like
that's all I need to say.
What they're trying to do is demonize us. No, that's not true. I have a lot of friends who are homosexuals. And I work with them. And I have friends in the Congress who are homosexuals.
There is a danger, though, in being, your opinions being conflated with those.
I mean, I could have said the same thing, you know, about you folks. A week ago last Saturday, we were in Bakersfield, and about 150 homosexuals showed up and shut us down. They denied our right for the permit we have obtained for a portion of the city park called Patriots Park in Bakersfield. Would not let us speak. Now, I don't wear that on my cuff.
What did you say?
There are concerns I'm sure some people carry with not so much a traditional values coalition, but those who would associate themselves with you, and that's a burden. There's your
Look,
latest.
I know of one person, and we have condemned them, and I got on a plane and flew to Laramie, Wyoming, for the trial of the people, the two men or three men, that murdered
Matthew Shepard.
And I was there, and I stood with the homosexuals to show them that this man must these people must receive the full justice of the law for that murder.
We'll get your comment, Evan, then we'll do closing statements.
Well, it's good, always good to have people saying gay people should not be killed. And that is certainly a step in the right direction.
I mean, the best thing you can do is make humor if something is very serious.
But what is very serious is when leaders in our society, day after day, going back decades, as your career has, Reverend Shelton, going back to your calls to quarantine people with AIDS.
I never said that.
You said to put them
in cities of refuge. No, and I referred to the hospitals that were closing should be used because the hospitals wouldn't take gays. And I said, then why don't we go to the Veterans Administration and get a congressional act and the funding so that those who are suffering from AIDS who cannot get in these hospitals to go to these hospitals that are being closed on the air bases.
Was it you who said where there's smoke, there's fire? Why is it that, people have this understanding of your position? But more important, because you're right, actually what your position is for you to say and people can look. What's more important is that leaders in our society, including organizations like yours, are mounting well-funded campaigns to take a group of people, a minority, and shove them outside the legal system of protections and responsibilities, not only through the law, bad enough as that would be, but through the constitutions. And in the course of your campaigns going back over decades to do that, you and others love to throw out statistics, including the kind you did tonight, make assertions of the kind you did tonight that deny the humanity of gay people, that deny their fitness as parents, that deny the needs of their children, that deny their desire to participate in legal institutions, that deny their claim to the American history of civil rights advance. And then you turn around and wonder why people see your rhetoric as somehow anti-gay or hateful or even inciting of discrimination and violence. Well, the answer to that is that this country has a choice. Either we are a country where all people have the right to be both equal and different, protected in their difference, whether it be religious difference or differences in race, sex, or sexual orientation, or we are not. And there are at least some of us who believe that America is better off when people who disagree can both be heard without being drowned out and without having the government used as a weapon to dictate how they should lead their lives or to exclude them from the protections and responsibilities afforded to other, including the freedom to marry.
Okay. We're going to try to stay on schedule and move into our closing statements. And you just moved right into it, didn't you?
No. I want my 20 more minutes.
Very much. No. And your closing statement, Reverend Sheldon.
Yes. Let me say, to begin with, that the institution of marriage is under attack. We fully believe that. It's not a minority of people. The CNN, USA Today poll has good merit. It was 68%. It's not a minority of people. It's not a minority of blacks. It's not a minority of Asians. It's not a minority of Hispanics at all. There's something intrinsic about the heterosexual relationship in marriage that is so germane that it must be preserved. Whatever the homosexuals want to do and whatever their sexual arrangement, however kind of sex they want to have, that's their business. And it's the privacy of their bedroom, the privacy of their home, fine. There should be no laws to stop them from that standpoint, unless there's some law that's being broken in terms of children and sex. Therefore, I am convinced that the institution of marriage needs to be given that preferred status in the law. And the reason is because it is marriage that gives birth, as J.D. Unwin said, and a later scholar, Carl T. Wilson, and our dance has turned to death. They have said that cultural energy is dissipated when families are reinterpreted and when families break down. And that is the glue, the relationship between husband and wife. Maybe some of you have come from broken homes, and that's a very sad thing. I've been blessed that I never had that experience. But when families are then reinterpreted, this is why. Because homosexuality is a gender identity conflict social issue. It is not to be a legal thing to be given special rights for. And that's basically what homosexuality has been asking for. And so we stand up for the one man, one woman relationship. And I'm sure that you're going to even be shocked, and I would predict that this could happen, that Hillary in her run for presidency, because she's already said that she supports one man, one woman marriage. She does not support, now she doesn't support a constitutional amendment, but she does support marriage only between a man and a woman. And I'm sure she's been to hell and back in that issue with, you know, her mate. So in closing, I thank you for the opportunity to come here and want you to know that this battle is not going to be ended soon. and it's going to continue. We're waiting for the Supreme Court of California to make their decision, and we're waiting for the Congress of the United States to get Social Security off the front burner and all the other issues so that we can reactivate. Now, last November, in conclusion, you had 17 states that voted a constitutional amendment to protect marriage. You already have 43 that have a Defense of Marriage Act. 43. All we need is 38. 43. Now you had 18 that passed a constitutional amendment, excuse me, 17 that passed a constitutional amendment last November. Of that 17, 12 said no civil unions. Now already pending is another 18 states, including California, where we're the sponsor of the constitutional amendment here. But there's another 18 states that have constitutional amendments pending this year in their respective legislatures.
Reverend, your time is up. All right, thank you very much. And 4 minutes from Evan.
Well, thank you. I just will point out that Lou Sheldon again declined to make clear that his proposed constitutional amendment would stop at denying marriage to gay people, but in fact, as he has drafted it and as the federal amendment that he pushes would also do, would preclude states from making their own decisions, including California, with regard not just to marriage, but to health benefits, to bereavement leave, to basic family protections, large or small, and indeed roll back the gains and advances and support and responsibilities that have been made in this state for same-sex couples and their kids. His agenda is not an agenda about marriage. It is an anti-gay agenda. And it is not just an anti-gay agenda. It is an agenda that is anti-choice, anti-civil rights, ultimately anti-women's equality, and anti-separation of church and state. Marriage has always been a battleground on which these larger questions of what kind of country we're going to have been contested. As I said earlier, whether it was ending the race restrictions, ending the government's interference in important personal choices about divorce or contraception or sexual intimacy, ending the legal subordination of women, time and time again, Americans have grappled with these large questions on this battlefield of marriage. We're met on that battlefield once again. But the stakes here are not just about gay people, important as that would be, for gay people too are human beings. The stakes are not just about marriage, important as that would be, because to be denied marriage is to be denied a range of tangible and intangible protections and responsibilities that literally cover every area of life from birth to death with taxes in between. If it were just about marriage, it would be important. But ultimately, this is not just about marriage. The civil rights question confronting California, confronting our nation yet again, is what kind of country we're going to be. Are we going to be a country that respects religious freedom and personal freedom and the values of love, commitment, and fairness for all? Or are we going to be a country that takes a minority, one group of families, one group of Americans, and shoves them outside the structure of law? That question is important to everyone, gay or non-gay, young or old, across the country and here in California. And it's not just an academic question that brings us into a conversation like this. It is a burning question of civil rights currently being fought over, in which some forces are trying to deprive the next generation of the power to think it through and rise to the better angels of our nature. Everyone has a stake in this battle. Everyone should make sure his or her voice is heard right here in California, right now.
Thank you. And thank you all.
There is a dinner in the law lounge downstairs for any of you who would like to attend that.
Are you staying for dinner?
Created with the trial edition of Mixcast Live from BigFeeder.com.